When the aliens come, no one will be safe. They will look to dominate and subjugate the human race, exterminating those they deem intelligent and smart enough to challenge their rule, and enslaving those who will work hard for them. None of which really explains what would happen to the failing writers, does it? The aliens need, like, court jesters or something?
We've got news.
Yeah, big news.
Big news. The kind of news that isn't like the boring news where everything's bad.
No, this is good news.
This is the good news. You know, the news with all the people doing horrible things and politicians lying about not doing horrible things, even though they probably did do horrible things.
This is the opposite, isn't it? This is the antidote.
Exact opposite.
Next week is the launch of our competition, our annual flash fiction competition. And once again, the kind people at Scrivener have jumped on board with us, and they are sponsoring the competition, which is fantastic. And next episode, we will be giving out the theme and the secret phrase that needs to be incorporated into your flash fiction entry, so you can write a little masterpiece and hopefully clean up with our biggest cash prize ever.
Wow. That was big.
That man made it sound big, but it is big.
I mean, it's so big. You've got to wonder what we do next year, Tom, because at this rate, we've just maybe upped the bar a little bit too much, is all I'm saying.
Maybe next year we'll claim it's a boutique competition.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then make it really small. And do you mean something?
Yeah, that's good, because the word boutique is like...
Gets you out of jail with anything. Is your hotel a little bit scruffy? Is it small and scruffy? Just call it boutique. It's fine. Yeah. So you have to get in this year while it's still a big competition before next year's boutique flash fiction competition. So yeah, tune in next episode for the magical, mystical phrase that has to be incorporated, and of course, the theme. And we have been underwhelmed with the number of people suggesting themes. It really has been amazing.
It has. Genuinely incredible.
But we'll be choosing a theme from our wheel of themes. I think, have we got a wheel of...
We can do a full
random selectometer.
We will be plucking one out.
Then how long have people got to write? How long is the competition lasting? About like 4 weeks or something to write it?
It's about that, Tom. Let's go
about
with
4 weeks. Yeah,
it's
3 or 4 weeks.
That. But
the other reason to listen next episode is that we will be speaking to someone who has very kindly said they will help us judge the competition.
Indeed.
So we'll have a little chat with them about what they think makes a good flash fiction story.
Yeah.
So well worth listening to the judge's opinion,
exactly.
I would say.
And they are massively qualified to do that as well, unlike us.
Yeah.
So that would be quite nice to talk to an actual qualified person who's got like an MA in creative writing and is currently doing a PhD and has won loads of flash fiction competitions rather than being kicked out the first
time. So enough about next episode's launch of our massive competition with our biggest ever cash prize in association with Scrivener. Let's focus on this week's episode. Who are we talking to this week, John?
Well, Tommy, this week our guest needs very little introduction, I feel, personally. Should we find out who the guest is by going through the magic writing portal and finding out? Do you do that?
You could just tell people.
Okay, we're going to talk to Patrick Ness. Oh, look, it's Patrick Ness.
Hello, Patrick.
Thank you so much for joining us, Patrick.
Yeah, I think you had a T at the end of my name there. I think you called me Patrick Nest.
Is that what it sounded like?
Yeah.
Well, we could change it if you want.
No, whatever you want. It's okay.
You like the Ness.
It's written there somewhere. It's completely fine.
If you care to look,
we've been massively blessed.
Because we get to talk
to a special guest.
Who's written so many books.
So much fat success.
Do you think it would be good?
Yes, I think it would be best.
Shut up, bloody poo!
And have a YA fiction fest.
Yes, we really bloody should.
Cause he's one of the best.
Chaos walking.
What a hat trick, yes.
So let's go and have a toast
to the writer Patrick Ness.
I don't feel like you need a great deal of introduction, but then I'm a fan of your writing, so I'm bound to say that. But for anyone who doesn't know, Patrick is best known for his young adult fiction, the Chaos Walking series and A Monster Calls being two of his many big successes. I'm thinking maybe that's a good place to start, actually. Writing for young adults. When I read your young characters, they really feel like young people. And I think you're very good at capturing, you know, the power of young people's emotions and their preoccupations and things. But as a man of kind of our generation, how do you go about doing that? How do you manage to resonate with young adults, do you think?
Well, first I'd like to say that this is actually the first podcast I've ever recorded. I think I'm sort of the last white man in civilization to not go on a podcast and talk about himself. So
welcome.
I figured it was probably time. So thank you. So, I mean, I assumed this would all be about crypto and wokeness, but okay, we'll talk about writing. Well, I believe that you are every age you ever were at all times. I mean, you carry yourself around every experience you've had, you carry yourself around. And my question, whenever I get this question, because I get it a lot, is why doesn't anybody else remember? I mean, are you purposely blocking it out? Because it's a part of your life story. It's there. It's a part of who you were. Mm. It's as much a part of who you were as when you turned 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever. And so why do we purposely block ourselves off or consider that time frame some kind of not real life, as if it's only testing ground?
Yeah.
And that's an argument I always have, which is that it's as real life to a 15-year-old. Their day is as real and vivid and important to them as ours are to us. So for me, it's just, I remember being that guy and I remember it being important. I remember what I felt, much like I remember being other ages. So I think it's always there. I think oftentimes people are just afraid to look at it with truth and clarity because it is an embarrassing and awkward time.
Yeah.
And it's a time when we were really figuring stuff out and making mistakes. But as a writer, as any kind of artist, I believe you can choose to look and not write, but I don't think you can choose not to look. I think you have to choose to see what's there.
Yeah.
And what you write about it is up to you. And how you write about it is up to you. And the words you use and what you select to portray is up to you. But I don't think you can choose to not look and still be any kind of a good, honest writer.
Mm. Well, I have a fairly terrible memory, so maybe that's where I go wrong with young adult fiction.
I don't believe that at all. I think you remember every single embarrassing thing that ever happened to you. I bet you remember every time, you know, you screwed up or said something wrong in class or a girl made fun of you. I bet you remember all of those.
I think I probably have consciously tried to block it out, though, a little bit.
Or when someone pooed in your bag.
That sounds very particular.
Thanks for bringing that up, Tom. That's a really delicate little bit of my life, that.
It is, yeah.
Can't believe you said that.
I thought you just came to me. See, I remember, yeah. No, I think it's true, though. I think people try and not try and forget about the childhood, but you're right, they're quite dismissive about the worthiness of it, or that it's there's a different worth of, you know, well, it's just kids being stupid. Do you remember? And they're quite dismissive of children around that age, and by default, I guess, dismissive of their own memories. Like you say, that it's just some kind of training ground. It's not real. It's just pretending, isn't it? Getting ready for being an adult.
Yeah, which is why I reject the idea.
Yeah. No, I'd massively agree with that. I have very, very strong memories and feelings of how I felt about situations when I was a kid, and do reflect those onto my kids in the same situation. Whereas I think for adults, it's very easy to say, well, it's just silly. How could you get upset about that? It's such a silly thing to get upset about. But if you actually delve back into your own childhood, you remember that at the time, it was important.
Mm.
Just to agree with you, Patrick. Sorry, it's kind of your interview.
Thank you. All done. Yeah. Thank you.
Do you feel like do you sort of make a conscious switch in your head when you're writing for younger people, or you're just writing? Do you know what I mean? Is there like I'm going to write for younger people now, or you're just thinking how it was to be that age?
Well, a lot of writers like to say, oh, I just write and I go where the story takes me and it tells me what it is. And that's true to an extent, but it's also massively disingenuous because I'm under contract to like a YA publisher, for example, for a book. And so it's disingenuous to say I'm just going to write any old thing and however it turns out. But it is true to an extent. I always think Something really important to me when I write is the voice of the story. And even if it's, you know, third person past tense, that's still a voice.
Yeah.
And so if I'm listening to a story, I can think, yeah, that does feel for younger people or for older, because I do write books for both. So it is a way the story tells it to you, but it's disingenuous to pretend that we're all just, you know, artists embarking on unknown journeys to start out with, and we're just lucky where they end up. So I don't think that's true, but an idea will feel right. I was writing Knife of Never Letting Go, the first book in the Chaos Walking trilogy, and I started it out as an adult novel. I wanted to write something in voice, in very particular voice, in sort of vernacular. And the first thing you find out when you write in vernacular is that it is way more fun to write than it ever is to read.
Yeah,
reading is a miserable experience.
Yeah, it's true.
But I kept simplifying and simplifying and simplifying. And there's a book called Ridley Walker by a British writer called Russell Hoban, who passed away a few years ago. And it's brilliant. It is an absolutely stunning novel. It was written in 1980, and it's set in a post-apocalyptic Kent, of all places. And it plays with language, and it's in very tough vernacular, but it is really worth the journey. And there is a certain kind of author, by which I mean white, male, and middle-aged, which I consider myself, who thinks, oh, I could do that. I'll give that a go. And I think that's how we got Cloud Atlas, which is great. I think that's how we got some of the more unreadable works of Will Self. And and I thought, I'll give it a go. And so I worked on it, and it was an adult novel to start. But as I kept pushing at the voice, and as I kept listening to what Todd sounded like, I thought, oh, this is younger. And this is probably for teenagers. And what I've always said is that the important decision I made at that time was to say, well, great. You know, there's no difference in the amount of emotional investment or artisanship or passion that I'm going to put into it if it's for teenagers. But great, that's what the story needs. So let me follow it and try to make it as best version of itself as I can. So, yeah, it's sort of true in one way or another. They're both kind of true. You sort of know, you sort of are also listening to what the story's telling you.
In terms of like the seeds of ideas, Patrick, you're very good at concept. Like, do you always start with a concept rather than a character or a plot device?
It really, really, really changes. It really is very different for...
Right.
I mean, I wish I had some set...
a map.
work that I could do. It would be a hell of a lot easier. But no, I mean, sometimes it's a big... Chaos Walking was a big question about how loud the world was getting and how loud it still is. And, you know, it started with the conceptual question of what would you do if you couldn't say no? What if you had to share everything? And what would that be like? And what would that be if you were young? So it started in a big, serious, conceptual way. But it also started, when I do school talks, I talk about Life for Never Letting Go. And I always say it started with one big, serious idea, which is the information overload idea. And it started with one stupid idea, which is I never liked books about talking dogs because I never thought that they would talk how a dog would actually talk. Because, I mean, if a dog could actually talk, they would talk about food, sex, and poo. And that's all I'm interested in. And that, to me, is hilarious. And also how much they love you, which is so funny.
Yeah.
And so Knife of Never Letting Go was two diametrically opposed concepts in seriousness. It was information overload, and it was trying to get a talking dog right. And out came the book. So I wish things were that easy to put together all the time, but they are definitely not.
Could you give us the setup of The Knife of Never Letting Go, just so that if people haven't read it, they can get a feel for what it is?
Everybody's read it. What are you talking about? It's a massive bestseller. What are you talking about? I think it's fine. It's a boy called Todd who lives in a place where everyone can hear what everyone else is thinking all the time, nonstop, whether you want to or not. It's called the noise. You can see it visually. You hear it. It's a cloud of stuff around everyone, all their thoughts. And we eventually learn that his town has no women in it because they were killed by the virus that caused this noise. And then we find out that that is emphatically not true. And he has to go on the run with a girl that he finds called Viola. Mm. So that's the setup.
Yeah.
It's three big books. It's the only trilogy I'll probably ever write. But when I went in to my publishers, it's one of those stories that I hesitate to tell because it's so rare that I don't want to give people the wrong impression, because it was actually my third book. I'd written two adult books before. So that's why this happened. It didn't happen on my, this was not a first novel. Mm. I went into my publishers with the first seven chapters, which was part one.
Yeah.
And I told them where this book would go, where book two would end, and where book three would end.
Right.
And they bought it on that. And that's a very rare experience because publishers just don't buy partials, certainly not anymore. Or if they do, it's so vanishingly small. I would never advise a writer to try for. I always advise finishing the book first. That's how I got my first book.
Oh, right. Interesting. Okay.
Finishing the book first, making it as good as you can.
Mm. Yeah.
Making them have to do as little work as they have to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how almost everyone gets their first book deal.
Mm. So let's talk about your first book deal. In fact, let's talk about how the journey began. Was it as smooth as it looks from the outside? Because from the outside, your career looks sort of perfect. It looks like a long stream of success.
No, it doesn't feel that way. it's funny. I grew up in a little forested Christian town in Washington State in the northwest of the U.S. Mm. And where, you know, nobody did anything like write a book, you know, nothing. And I think this famous person from my high school, which is now me, but the previous most famous person.
Is it called the Patrick Ness High School now?
It's not. It's called Franklin Pierce. It's named after literally the worst president the United States ever had, even with Trump. Yeah. The previous most famous person was the guy who did the automotive version of Drag Race, not the fun version, but the car version of Drag Race. He was a drag racer. So I thought that's never going to happen to me. You know, I thought only famous people get book deals, which doesn't make sense, but it kind of makes a kind of sense, but it doesn't make sense. But I have a couple of writing philosophies, and one of which is that real writers don't write, they write anyway. And so I didn't think I'd get a book deal ever, but I wrote a book anyway.
Right. Yeah.
And that to me is what really, really separates, you know, wannabes from real writers. I've always thought is that you feel like it's never going to happen, but you do it anyway because it's what you want.
You can't help yourself. Yeah. Was that book Crash of Hennington?
It was.
Okay.
Read in its dozens by friends and family.
So was that a big break then? Would you consider that?
Yeah, it was a massive break.
Yeah.
I mean, all I absolutely wanted was to hold a hardcover in my hand that I'd written myself. Seems so impossible. Seems so...
very much does seem impossible.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not impossible. That's the thing.
Well,
yeah. Well, you got to finish a book. Remember Real Writers Write Anyway?
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that does help.
Is this the part where you guys are being lazy? Isn't that what this podcast is about or something?
Sometimes.
So it does seem easy. It does. My pathway seems clear, certainly in retrospect. Mm. But what I did is I wrote a book. I wrote the whole book. And then I got an agent. And then she got me a publishing deal. And that seems really, really easy. It is really, really not. You know, I sent it to, I think my final list of agents I sent it to, I think I sent it to 65 people.
Wow.
Of whom I think maybe 5 or 6 wanted to read the whole manuscript. And at the end, 2 offered representation. And I went with 1 and she's been my agent ever since. And then she got it published to my absolute astonishment. And everything since then has been cake. I don't know what the hell. I feel like someone's going to go, we need to rectify this mistake.
Do you remember that? Did you have a plan in mind or were you just kind of going stage by stage because you'd finished the book and then you'd found an agent? And then, Jeremy, was it just happening?
Yeah, it was stage by stage.
So you didn't have some master plan of what you wanted to do or be or...
Oh, well, there's fantasy, but...
Obviously, the ridiculous... Well, obviously I want to be a best-selling author.
Yeah.
30 books under my belt. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all because it sort of establishes a pathway for you in your head.
It
makes it more and more possible. So that might not happen, but you're, in a way, it's giving yourself permission to keep moving forward, which is how I tried to use it. But no, I mean, writing a novel is so challenging and it's such a long process that just my temperament, how I work and, breaking it down into small steps because I can feel a sense of accomplishment at the completion of each small step. Mm. I went at publishing the same way. I thought, okay, I'll send it to 5 more agents today and then I'll send it to 5 more agents tomorrow and I'll make a spreadsheet because I'm a dork who loves spreadsheets and it makes me feel like I have control over the world, even though I don't. And it worked out that way. And I have not had a plan since. I didn't plan on writing for young adults. I didn't plan on writing films. I feel like what I tried to do was give myself permission to try anything. Mm. I've taught writing a couple of times. I taught writing at Oxford for years. And I always tell them at the start, you know, this class is practice. I can't teach you to become good. I can correct stuff and give you suggestions, but mainly it's about giving permission, saying, try this or try that. And that's how I've really tried to view my career of saying, I'm the only one who decides what I write. And that's in terms of format, that's in terms of age group, that's in terms of genre. And it's something I've really, really gripped onto very, very tightly. I've not allowed a publisher or elsewise to say you can only write in this box. Mm. So that's... It seems like it's been planned. It very much has not.
And is that something that's happened to you then with publishers or agents that they've tried to take you down a certain path or suggested you might want to write something like this, or the big bestseller maybe, and you've resisted or not, or have they just known to not bother with you? Just leave him because he's just going to do what he wants anyway.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, but I don't. That makes me sound like some sort of monster.
Some amazing diva. Yeah. Oh, I'm not writing that.
Yeah, but it's really not. Honestly, the person who's put more expectation on me is myself. My first novel, Crush Hennington, came out, and they marketed it as a political satire, and so I thought I must be a satirist then. And that is kind of a miserable place to be in when you think, am I a satirist? Have I ever been one? And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to write one. I mean, since this is a failing writers podcast, it's the place to share it. I don't think I've ever talked about it. But
yeah,
I wrote my first novel. I wrote two more novels after that my adult publisher did not want.
Whoa. Now we're getting down to it.
Yeah. And eventually they said, well, we like short stories. Can we do a short story collection? So I collected what I'd written already and I wrote about five more. And that was my second book, was a short story collection.
So what was what was wrong with those other novels? What was the
one? One was fucking awful. I mean, so fair enough.
Okay, well that will affect people choosing to publish things. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, that was me trying to be a satirist.
Right.
And boy, it didn't work. I am not that. And and the second one I think is quite sweet, and just might have been too sweet. And I was trying something, and it just didn't hang together. And I don't think they were wrong decisions from the publishers as much as it was crushing at the time.
I was going to say at the time, because obviously. You'd had that, like you say, breakthrough. And then was it just like, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe that was just a fluke.
Yeah, I thought I'd blown it. I thought I'd got a great chance and I thought I'd blown it. It was so, as you guys must know, I mean, writing is such a huge act of faith in yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm. And all the while you have to be also super thin skinned and really sensitive. So how's that supposed to work? But again, real writers don't write that right anyway. And so I got to this point where my first book, Crash Finnington, came out. The short story collection came out and did pretty well for a short story collection, which is not going to ever set the world on fire, but did pretty well. But then my publisher, which was called Flamingo, was at HarperCollins, and that imprint was closed at HarperCollins, and they folded it into Fourth Estate. And suddenly I didn't have a contract. I didn't have an editor. And I thought, this is it. You know, I've had my shot, and I'm really lucky because it's more than most people have ever had, you know, so just try to be happy with that. But I wrote anyway, and I got the idea for Knife of Never Letting Go, and I talked about it with my agent, and she is also the agent for Derek Landy, who does these Skullduggery Pleasant books for middle grade, and they're wonderful. And she said, well, you know, she said, everybody in the children's world knows me now, and so why don't we talk to people? Mm-hmm. So again, not a big plan, just a moment of despair. I was living in Oxford for a year, and I just was not happy, and so this unbelievable thing happened. Where Knife of Never Letting Go happened.
Did that happen quite quickly?
They took it up really fast, Walker did. And I met other people, and it was the first time I've ever done a bidding thing, which is just a ridiculous position to be in. You know, it feels like this is really pinch yourself kind of thing, because it's never going to happen again. But yeah, they took it on, and I wrote pretty quick, and the books came out 1, 2, 3 in 3 years. And so suddenly there I was. I was a YA author, and those did really well. Yeah, I think it was 2008, so I would have been 37. So it's not you know, it didn't happen when I was 21.
It happened
later, after I'd had some books that did not do well, and, you know, after a lot of struggle and after writing books that didn't get published. But again, you know, write anyway, because God knows.
Yeah. Well, I'm really pleased to hear that you do still qualify kind of as a failing writer. Mm. You're allowed on this podcast now.
Yeah.
I saw a brilliant tweet of yours last week saying, I wrote 3 sentences and celebrated by having lunch. I then celebrated lunch by deleting those 3 sentences. I felt like, despite your success, I think you're kind of one of us a little bit.
Well, I mean, that tweet was even a lie. I hadn't written anything.
You were including the tweet as what you'd written.
I was, yes.
Wow.
Clever.
I had not had a good morning that morning. Yeah. It's fine. I keep at it. It's fine.
The thing is with Scrivener, order in a different write you can and source it out all you four.
Hey, I don't think that's not really how it works, Tom.
Just type in any old nonsense.
No.
And out pops a finished novel. And a finished novel.
Right. That is not how it works. I mean, it does help you organise stuff.
Why is this not working?
It definitely means you can shift chapters around and make notes and attach them to the right bits of writing.
Well, just press the buttons and it comes out, doesn't it?
Link to web research so it's all at your fingertips and loads more. Basically helps organise your writing on another level.
It's not blooming working!
Plus, it's great for productivity too because you can set daily word count targets, keep track of your writing progress and stuff like that. It really does do everything you need it to if you write. Whatever you write.
Why is it not written my book for me?
Well, you know, almost everything.
Get a 30-day free trial of Scrivener right now at literatureandlatte.com and use the code FAILING to get 20% off when you sign up.
Going back to concepts, the first book of yours that I read, Patrick, was The Rest of Us Just Live Here, which is, I love that book. It's about a group of young people, like literally living on the periphery in that they're sort of out in the sticks, but they're also kind of living on the periphery of a big teen sci-fi fantasy story that's going on, but they're not really involved in it. I love that idea. I think as you know, especially as a teenager, I think life can feel a bit like that, especially with social media. It feels like you're sometimes an extra in someone else's much more interesting story.
Yeah.
Was that the seed of that novel?
It definitely was. It was, what did the people in Buffy's class think? Yeah, who were right. Just trying to graduate, you know, and here they blow up again, you know, and it made me laugh. Actually, the whole thing started in even a sillier place, which I was talking to a friend of mine, Gino Dawson, the author Gino Dawson, and we were making fun of hero and heroine names in YA books.
Oh, yeah. Because
There's a joke in the book that pretty much most of the chosen ones in the book that they're all called Finn. There's so many called Finn that they have to be numbered. And the heroine is called Satchel, and it's, you know, and there's somebody called Wisconsin, you know, and it's, and we were just laughing about this, and because it's true. And so I said, why isn't there never a book about Mike? And so that little throw out joke was like, oh, actually, is there something there? And so I started thinking about the book of Mike. And and you know, I always say to myself that I know an idea is working if other ideas start sticking to it.
Yes, yeah.
That's dead right, yeah.
You need trees after trees after trees to make the forest of a book, and one idea isn't going to cut it. And so I started thinking about this idea about the book of Mike, and I thought about the chapter headings, because the story of the Chosen One is told just in the chapter headings in a Victorian style, chapter the first in which, you know, while the other story is happening in the books, I thought about, okay, what else is happening? Who are these people? And I got this idea of something which I thought was funny, because I thought the thing that people don't talk about modern teenagers is that they volunteer a huge amount. They're the largest volunteering demographic. They are, you know, much kinder and more generous of themselves than newspapers give them credit for. So I had this idea of, what if you were part God, but it wasn't anything useful? And you were a teenager who was part god of something ridiculous. And so I had this idea of somebody who was one quarter, because his grandmother was one quarter god of cats. And I thought, what would you do if you were a teenager who had this ridiculous godhood and cats have followed you around and so on? And how would you do about it? And I thought, you know, the way you would traditionally go about it is that he would scorn cats and, you know, try to avoid cats. And I think, no, actually a teenager, they take on huge responsibilities. And I'll bet the funnier path of this is a guy who's like, all right, I'm quarter god of cats, you know. And so whenever he enters the scene, he just quietly blesses the cats who are there and it gets on with life. And that just struck me as so funny and so true and so poignant in a way that I thought, this is a real character that I can use. And so that's one of the ideas that stuck to it. And then more started sticking to it. And like I said, I wish I knew. I wish I had the recipe every time.
No, I loved it. It was brilliant.
I really love that book. I'm really proud of that book.
I want to do like a little circle back round to the Chaos Walking series, because you co-wrote the screenplay for the film as well. How did you find that experience?
I have been lucky enough to have two books made into movies. One is Chaos Walking and one is Monster Calls. And Monster Calls, I wrote every single word of that screenplay. And I worked really closely with the director. I'm so proud of that film. I think Monster Calls really works. I think it does everything I want it to.
Yeah, it's great.
The director brought stuff that I would never have dreamed of, which is exactly what you want in collaboration. Chaos Walking was a different experience. Chaos Walking was big, 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 big studio.
Yeah.
I was one of many writers. I don't think I'm giving any game away by saying that there are two writers credited, but there were a lot more people behind the scenes. So that was, let's put it this way, I learned a lot. I don't think the final movie is particularly good, and that's disappointing in one way, but I remember I was on a book tour in Germany and the Chaos Walking movie had been announced, and this girl said, what if it comes out and it's not good? And so I said, is that what happened to you when they adapted your best-selling book into a $100 million film? And she went, that was very mean. But I mean it like, how can I complain? It's ridiculous.
Well, yeah. It's true.
This experience is so amazing. It's ridiculous for super skinny, gay, weird, anxious little me living in the forest of Puyallup, Washington. To be on this massive set with all the stuff I made up. How can I'm not trying to be pie in the sky here, and I'm not trying to avoid saying anything negative, but it's ridiculous. What a ridiculous thing to feel like you have a right to be pissed off about. Come on.
Yeah.
Great experience.
Well, presumably when you're writing a screenplay for that kind of film, I mean, it must be relatively obvious early on that you have to change quite a lot for a movie. You know, you can't keep everything. And you can't keep everything the same. They are different things, aren't they, books and movies? Were you kind of going along with that? Like, okay, I get it. Yeah, this has got to be very different. This has got to be different. Or did it feel a little bit sacrilegious? I can't imagine how it must feel to take something that was entirely your thing and then, you know, have all these people kind of, you know, rush into
it. Yeah, break it into little bits and chuck some of the bits away, but then rebuild some of the other bits in a different shape.
And I had a couple of experiences about that. One is I've worked on adapting other people's books into films. Mm. And I remember I got brought in on a script for, I won't mention the book or the author. It hasn't been filmed, but it's a big bestseller book.
Because it was a massive flop. I thought you were going to say that.
But it's a big bestselling book. And they sent me notes from the author. And it was like 9 pages of "You've broken my heart."
Oh God!
You know, and I thought, well, that's like the first way you're gonna make people stop listening to you. And also, in my mind, the book remains. The book stays. The book isn't being rewritten.
That's a really, really good point.
People can still buy it and still see my 100% personal version of it. And when I'm writing the screenplays for things I'm adapting, I always think of it as a remix. Mm. You know, it's got the same stuff. It just is in a different form. So it has different needs. I think it is easier when it's not your work.
Yeah.
But, you know, Monster Calls has differences in it. And I think they're great. He added a whole new ending.
Yeah.
That, you know, we talked about it and I wrote it, but I loved it and I hadn't thought of it. And I thought it's just the perfect way to end a film because a film is a different experience than the book. He said, you know, a book you can put down, but in a film, you're sitting there communally for 2 hours. And you are being guided. And if you are guiding someone to a destination, you know, it's different than guiding them to a destination in a book because you've held them here for this set period of time. So where are you going to leave them? And I bought that argument and worked on a different ending. And he had a great idea and I wrote it and I really love it. I think it's perfect ending for the film. It's not the perfect ending for the book. And that's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fine.
Can we talk about Monster Calls then and where that came from? It's extraordinary, really, isn't it? Rather unique.
Yeah. I mean, I would never have seen it coming. There was a really wonderful writer called Siobhan Dowd, who'd written 4 books for teenagers, really good ones, really good ones. But she wrote them knowing that she had terminal cancer. And this was, Monster Calls was meant to be her 5th book. We shared the same editor at the time, and Siobhan had perfectly planned to write it. There was supposed to be enough time, but she fell ill and died much sooner than she or anyone expected. And so my editor said, you know, I have this material. Would you take a look at it? To me, she said, you know, would you take a look at it? Would you consider turning it into something? And I was really hesitant because a book has to be a book. It can't be a eulogy, because if it's eulogy, it's eulogy. It's not a story. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, I was going to say no. I was really very intent on saying no, actually, because I didn't want to feel like the story had to be bound.
It's quite a lot of pressure, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But something I was going to say earlier, like when I was talking about turning in books that I want to write, is like there's possibly a diva element to that a little bit. But my co-agreement with that is that it's okay to do that. And it's okay to stick to my guns as long as I deliver. That's my job. I have to prove that I'm right. I can't just ask them to accept it. I have to prove to them that I am. And so that's how this felt. The pressure was the same. It was, All right. I said, you know, I read her materials. It was about 1,000 words and it had this structural idea about the stories. And it had a few of the characters, but not all of them. And while I was reading it, I got this image. And the image was Connor, the lead character, coming out of what I didn't know at the time, what it would be. I thought maybe a dream or something, to find that he had destroyed his grandmother's sitting room, including her precious clock. And to me, wherever that image came from, that felt like, oh, this is the book. There's so much power here. There's the transgression. There's all the stuff that as a child, he's not allowed to speak, but he's feeling, and nobody will give him an outlet for. And so I said to my editor, our editor, I will do this, but in the least egotistical way possible, I've got to have full control, because that's what Siobhan Dodd would have done. She would have let the story go where it was ever supposed to go. So I said, you've got to let me do that. And in return, my agreement is I deliver the right story for this interesting situation. But that is a story, because she's a storyteller first and I'm a storyteller first. And my editor said, yeah, let's see what happens. And she expected it to be I expected it to be a short, small illustrated book. I had no idea that it would take off like it did. And we got Jim Kay to illustrate it, who is just magnificent.
Yeah.
They're beautiful, those pictures.
Yeah. So it feels like a collaboration between the three of us. So like when the stage productions happen, a portion of it always still goes to the Siobhan Dodd Trust, which buys books for poor children. You know, so it's an unusual place. And I think it only works because she had a story to tell, and I was given the freedom to let that story grow into something.
Yeah, it really feels like your book, you know, like you've taken it on and done your thing with it. There's a kind of thread that runs through a lot of your work, which is that kind of belief that people aren't good or evil. You know, we're all complex products of the world around us. And it feels like that, you know, that's a real kind of key thing.
Yeah, and I think it is. It is something I genuinely believe, because if someone is all bad is actually a boring character, for one thing, but someone's all bad is also, there's no chance of redemption. And you don't always get redemption, but if there's no chance of it, then that also is not interesting to me, because I think that the world is more complex than that. You know, I've always thought that sentience, awareness of death, awareness of ourselves, was an evolutionary accident. It gave us these incredible skills, these incredible survival skills, but I don't think we were ready for it. And I think it completely fucked us up in our brain. As I said, you know, we invented religion to take away our fear of death. And we invented comedy to take away our fear of life. And that's where our big artistic social, you know, constructs come from. And so, yeah, I really always argue for the glorious messiness of a human being, because we are, even the most dickish people, probably like their dog. You know what I mean? It's just something sometimes as simple as that. And it doesn't mean they're good people, and doesn't mean you shouldn't fight them, but it's more interesting to me. And it's interesting to say that too, because again, here I go talking about myself, because people ask me sometimes your overarching themes. Like, I'm not aware I have overarching themes until I look back and see what I've written. And I think my first 5 or 6 books for teenagers were all in one way or another about how to survive after the end of the world. And it never occurred to me while I was writing them that was the theme, you know. And that's an art, because I was raised in a really apocalyptic Christian household, you know, speaking in tongues and the rapture.
So
they are all arguments for what you do after the world ends. You get back up and you make a new one. So,
Do you, as a writer, are you someone that has piles and piles of ideas scrawled in notebooks ready for the next 37 novels? Or are you... Do you take it as it comes and wait for the idea to drop?
I tend to take it as it comes.
Yeah.
That's really scary.
That's the scary way of doing it, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really scary.
When your British goes, right, that last one was brilliant. That was a massive success. Yeah. What's the next one? And you're like, give me a minute.
Yeah. And there have been periods where, you know, I've not published for a year just because I was thinking about what's the next right thing. And it's real scary. Mm. It is. And I wish they came easier. And no, I don't have a notebook. I wish I did. But it's always sort of worked out. And so I kind of cling to that. I always think,
there's truth in that, isn't it? When you're in the middle of the mess thinking, I'm blank, I've completely, you have to think, well, it's always worked before. Something has always dropped into place. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm working on an adult novel now, and I've had the idea for a long, long time. And I'm finally trying to write it. And it's very, very challenging and going very, very slowly. And so I am in, I think I'm hitting about the halfway point, which is always, it's not as liberating as it feels like it should be. You know, because I'm like, oh, shit, I've got to do this all again, you know? And sometimes it's a sludge, but I feel like as long as I keep moving forward, even at a snail's pace, I'm at least moving forward.
What do your first drafts look like? Are they pretty refined, or are they, okay, I'm going to delete that and go back to the start?
No, they're a complete mess. They are an absolute disaster.
Good to know.
Because I go in, as a rule, I go in telling myself nobody's going to read this, and nobody does read my first drafts.
Right.
And what that does is it gives me the freedom to make mistakes, to change my mind, and
experiment a bit.
Yeah. And 90% of the time, what happens is I get to the 90% done and go, oh, that's what it's about. And because I'm operating on instinct. And and then you go, then for a second draft, I go back and make it look like that's what I meant all along. And that's basically novel writing for me. It's a real, like I keep saying act of faith, but it genuinely is. I got to trust my instincts because they've helped me out so far. And that I also have to trust that if I screw something up really badly, I can fix it.
Mm. So are you outlining a fair amount before you actually kind of kick off writing, or are you've got the idea, but you're leaving it fairly loose?
I definitely don't outline. I know writers who do. And so I'm not saying don't outline if that's your thing, but I really hate them. I feel like I'm doing the hard work of writing a novel, but in the most unpleasant way possible. And so I tend not to outline. But having said that, I tend to have a loose structure in my head. I also tend to have a last line.
Oh, wow.
Which is, I call it the dismount, because you got to nail it. And I tend to have a structural idea, because for me, rhythm is really important. And that can be the most simple thing in the world. I mean, like in Life of Never Letting Go, I thought, no, keep the chapters to this, I think it was like 5,000 words or 4,000 words. And so it becomes the thing where you're challenging yourself to do what you need to do within a certain parameter. And restrictions are spurs to creativity, I think. Because the rhythm was important. This is how the chapters need to feel. Bum, 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 bum. And for the book I'm writing now, the lengths are the same, but there's sort of different styles in each chapter, sort of 8 big chapters. And so I've laid out what those will probably be, and trying to keep the rhythm of that up. I don't know. I want enough so I don't feel like I'm lost. I don't want enough to feel like, I don't want so much that I feel like I'm shackled.
Yeah.
So sometimes that's as simple as knowing an image or two that I'm really excited to write.
Yeah.
Sort of like the 2/3 way. And I don't write it till I get there, but I know that I'm aiming towards something.
And do you always hit that last line?
Mostly.
Right. Okay.
I have changed them, but mostly I do, because they feel like when that comes, they feel like, that's how I want to leave the reader. Yeah. You know, it's the exit feeling. And if I can achieve that, I mean, you know, you can go too far in that. You can really go too far in that. So I've really tried to be loose about it when I can, because like, you remember 3 Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a good film, but the final scene does not match the rest of the film. And I watching that, I'm thinking, he wrote the last scene first. And come hell or high water, whatever happened in the story before, he was going to put this final scene. And I thought, that's what you can't do. You've got to let the story tell you that you've gone a different way.
Could I get you to put your creative writing tutor hat on now, Patrick? Because
stop being so fucking lazy.
I'm done. that is all the advice we need. Thank you, Patrick. We like to dabble with a bit of short story writing. Mm-hmm. Do you still write short stories?
Yeah, once in a while. I do, yeah. When I get an idea, I definitely do.
So you've got have you got another book of short stories? Almost. No.
Not yet.
Okay, so you're our private creative writing tutor. Is there any kind of general advice for writing really great short stories? It's a big question.
Yeah, no. No, there is not. I mean, that's, when I was in college, the sort of accepted conventions is that you were either a Raymond Carver short story writer or you were a Borges short story writer. Mm. And so you either were a massive naturalism, realism, blah, 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 blah. You were massively experimental. I tended towards Borges, but the idea that one was right and one was wrong always pissed me off. And no, in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I think at UEA, you're often taught to capture the moment. And that's fine. There are great examples of that in short story form, but I object to the idea that that's the only way to do it. And so I suppose that would be my first advice, is that there is not one way to do it. If you capture a moment, fine, capture a moment. And then read Alice Munro and William Trevor and find out how you're never going to be as good as them. And I'm kidding about that. But I think it's just, you know, my best writing advice is spite and defiance are incredible motivators. They are just the best for me. They are the best way to get my ass moving. I was once on a panel with another YA writer who remains the worst human being I've ever met personally. And this person said to me on a panel in front of a crowd, "Patrick, you can't write literary novels and be a bestseller." And I said, "Well, maybe you can't." And so I really believe that. I mean, I think of something that, you know, someone has told you can't do. And then the response to that is watch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was once speaking, I think it was in Norwich, and this guy in the crowd said, "You know, I really want to be a writer and I really, you know, I get ideas." I said, "But I can't just sort of, I can't make myself sit down and write." And so I said, "Well, maybe you're not a real writer." And he got mad. And I said, "Good, you should get mad. I mean, your response should be, fuck you. I'm going to show you. I'm going to go sit down and write." And I hope he did. But that's what I mean. If treat it as an act of defiance, as an act of rebellion. I mean,
Tom, maybe we need to be less encouraging towards each other.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but no, what I mean is, definitely be encouraging to each other. But what I mean is, say fuck you to the idea that a short story has to be one thing.
Mm.
That's what I mean. It can be anything you want. You can sell anything as long as you sell it. So I suppose that would be my first big advice is stop trying to think you have to do a short story in a particular way because that's how other people, that is just not true. So that would be advice number one, is write with defiance.
I think that's great advice for any writer, actually, isn't it? Not even short stories. That's just, that goes across anything. But if you try and write in a certain kind of way, it's got to come from inside, doesn't it? It's got to be just what you want to do.
It does.
Not because what you think someone else might want to read, possibly, or whatever.
You know, and you look at the books that connect with people. Not all of them are brilliantly written, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But what I always say is that the books that really, I think, the ones that really connect with people are a writer sitting down and just writing, because this is my other big advice. And this seems like, it seems vacuous, but if you think it through, I mean it in a very particular way, which is the surest way to both satisfaction and potential success is writing a story you want to read yourself. Because you'd be amazed at how many people still don't. You know, but nobody wanted the first carry. You know, he just wanted to write that story, you know, and God bless him. Dan Brown couldn't write his way out of a, you know, a supermarket, but he's clearly wanting to write the Da Vinci Code, and his joy of writing it is there. It's fucking terrible, but his joy is on the page. And that's, I think, what people respond to, that he's writing a story he wants to read himself. And it's like, come along with me while I tell this exciting thing. So no matter how weird it seems, or how uncommercial even, I think if you're writing and your jets are firing because you're having a hell of a time, your reader is going to respond no matter what it is.
That's very good advice.
I think that's brilliant advice.
And I'm not really sorry for insulting Dan Brown. He's got millions. He's fine.
He'll be all right.
He'll be all right. He'll be fine.
So he'll be listening to this and going, "Oh, that's really upset me, that, because I really like, I love Patrick's stuff. Why would he say that about my stuff?"
I know, that's the, God, that's the,
I believe he said that.
That is the sad thing. I mean, I once tweeted something about a really famous person and then I met them and I'm like, "Oh, shit." Please don't ever search yourself in my name, please. Yeah. So it's like, I really try not to do that anymore, but I think Dan's going to be okay.
Do authors diss each other a lot? I saw another tweet of yours recently where you were saying that there's been more than one occasion where an author's got a bit drunk and said that you shouldn't have ended The Knife of Never Letting Go the way you did.
Yeah, I mean, honestly...
Is that normal?
No, honestly, the truth is no, because it's such a... If you're lucky to get published, you know how hard it is and you know what it takes to get there. And the community, particularly in the UK, the UK YA community especially, is fantastic. Mm. And, you know, as gossipy as any community, but, but missing, not really. I mean, we all know a few bad behaviors. And
so it's the same people, is what you say.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, I remember, I won't say this author's name, but there was an author, when Crash of Innington came out, publisher said, "Do you know anyone who can give us a cover quote?" And I was like, "No, I don't know anybody. I mean, you're kidding." But I said, "Here's some authors that I like." And I listed them. And one of them was this particular author. And they sent it to this particular author. And he wrote back this lengthy email saying how much he hated the book.
Oh, right.
It wasn't any good. And that the sentences were terrible and that they needed to not publish it.
Wow.
Did you? And this was a big author at the time. And
did that go on the cover or not? Or did you decide not to?
I once got a. That's funny though, because I once got a really bad review from Ursula Le Guin in The Guardian, and I was fine. I was really fine with it because all I could think of was Ursula Le Guin read my book. but there was one sentence in the review that was really positive, so she's on the cover.
Brilliant.
It's all flim flammer. But like this guy, this author is like, why would you do that? Why? Well, to take the time and the effort to do that. You know, that's not, you know, that's you're gonna find monsters anywhere, but the monsters, it's like monstrous actors. They tend not to last forever. They tend to disappear and you wonder why they disappeared, and you realize it's behind the scenes just because they were a prick.
Yeah.
So this guy is.
Are you saying this author disappeared?
Yeah. So yeah, that's what happened to this guy. He was huge in 2003. Not huge anymore. Who's laughing now?
It's difficult to imagine writing something like that. It's not difficult to imagine writing something like that. You could be in a bad mood that day, couldn't you? And think, do you know what? I've had it with these young upstart authors coming in and, right, that's it. I'm going to tell them what it. You'd write it and then you think, but do you know what? I'm not a massive twat. I'm not going to send that.
Yeah.
I'll just put it in the bin. I'll delete that. No, come on. Get a grip.
In a way, I could use the experience because it's like, it didn't kill me. You know what I mean?
It's more of that spite you could harness.
Spite I could harness.
Yeah, and someone can have that opinion, someone who purportedly would know and has a depth of knowledge to give a valid opinion, but it doesn't chime with a lot of the rest of the world, does it? So yeah. Everyone has their own peculiar opinions on things. So yeah,
you have to be super sensitive, but with a thick skin.
Yeah.
Manage that paradox.
Yeah, I think I'm missing the thick skin bit of that.
Well, we've got some pearls of advice, haven't we, this time out, John?
Yes.
Very succinct nuggets of writing advice that we can... Yeah.
You know what we need to do, Tom, is write a book and just kind of claim them all
as
our own.
Well, no, we can do it and we just attribute them to people, but through our... Yeah, we'll be the conduit for it.
Yeah, nice. Let's do it.
Well, you need to write a book for it.
Maybe next year. Let's talk about... Sorry, lastly, I just want to talk about Different for Boys is your latest book. Kind of a novella about the nuances of male teenage relationships and I guess like the subtle degrees of sexuality that you find in the world. But it's very, very beautifully observed. It's very eye-opening. I really enjoyed it. It felt like a book that you wish you'd been able to read growing up as a young gay man. Yeah. Was that the starting point, or am I over-projecting?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, that's often the case in when I'm writing for a young person. It's what did I want that I wasn't getting?
Right. Yeah.
And I said it to a lot of people who write for young adults. You know, it's why there needs to be a lot of different kind of voices telling stories, because you know, I can't tell everybody's story, but I can tell mine, and I can tell mine in a way that hopefully will connect to somebody who's gone through the same things as I have. Not in a therapeutic way, because I tend to resist a little bit about the idea of writing as therapy. You know, I mean, I do explore stuff and I do explore stuff for my own life in it, but therapy is for therapy, because it needs to be a story first. But this was definitely something I would have wanted to talk about. It was part of an anthology first.
All right.
And Losing It, which was controversial, or you know, trying for controversy a little bit at the time, I think. And it was about losing your virginity for teenagers, you know, an anthology of different writers writing about that subject. And it's a good anthology. It's really good. This guy called Keith Gray who put it together. He's a really talented writer. And there's lots of like Nova Burgesses in it and Anne Fine and lots of really good people. And but it brought up a question that I'd always had, which is we have one single definition of losing your virginity as a society. And it does not apply in all cases, you know. And so what does it mean for a boy who likes boys if he's not going to do that one thing that society says, losing your virginity to a girl in this particular way, then when do you lose it? And what does it mean when you lose it? And what does it mean when you get to decide? And so that's where the idea started. It's I thought, well, have a guy giving a list of all the things he's done and then saying, but am I still a virgin? And then I thought, well, you can't actually do that because that's, you know, that's far too explicit for... the intended readership. But I thought, you could censor it. I got this idea of putting black boxes over all the swear words and all the times they talk about sex, because we can't talk to teenagers like teenagers talk to teenagers. And so that felt like a really fruitful idea. And it sort of grew thematically too, because the characters are aware of these black boxes. They're aware that they're being bleeped out.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I guess I can't talk about that, even though it's part of my life and I'm experiencing it. So the black boxes became also a way of exploring what the closet is like.
Yeah.
Behind behind the black box? What does it mean if you have to live your life behind the black box? And the only liberating thing about the closet is that you can decide what the closet is like. It's still terrible. It's a terrible place to be. But, you know, you can make the rules of what the inside of that closet is like. And so that tension of who you are behind the black box and who you are in real life felt really, really tasty. And it just, it ended up in this story, which is sort of autobiographical, not all of it, not nearly all of it. But I thought, here's a way to talk about censorship, which goes on a lot, which has gotten so much worse in the last year for teenage books. But what the goal is always, 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 always to tell a human story. All these fun devices are great and they're really fun to write, but if they don't have a human story behind them, they can be hollow. I'm all for experimentation, but, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is a great film because it's experimental, but because it's also really, really good drama.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my sort of, you know, gold standard, what I'm trying to aim for. I can do all these tricks and I can have all these fun stuff, but can the people in it also be real? And can they be funny? Can they be moving? And that's exciting to me when I'm to write. That feels like defiance. That feels like defiance. Like, I'll show you that you can't do this, you know, kind of thing. So that's where it came from. And the response has been really nice. I'm really pleased about that. It's a nice surprise.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. Books like that are important because, you know, I always like to see the world through a different set of eyes. But they're also, obviously, they're brilliant for people who feel kind of marginalized and you know, especially young people realize that they're not alone, you know, what they're feeling is normal. And yeah, it's brilliant.
Thank you.
And I like the device as well. I thought that was very good because it does, like you say, it sort of adds to the comedy. And in a way, as a reader, you get to decide with the sort of redacted bits, you kind of get to decide how you want to fill the blanks. How far do you want to go? How explicit do you want to be in your own head? It's very clever. It's good.
I mean, it's no Da Vinci Code, but it's...
It's definitely no Da Vinci Code. I've really fallen short there.
But well done anyway.
Good for you. The last thing I'd want to say about that, and it's sort of about the stuff we were talking about, is I didn't ask anybody permission to write black boxes, if you see what I mean. I didn't go to anybody and say, this is what I'm thinking of doing. What do you think? That to me is another little bit of writing advice, is don't ask permission.
Are you saying that because you suspect that people would have knocked it back?
I don't know if they would have, but I wasn't going to give them the chance. Because
it's almost like you've got the full concept in your head to some extent. And no matter how well you explain it, it's not the finished article, is it? And it's very easy for them to go, oh, I don't really get that. Well, would it? And they start. Yeah. It's human nature for them to then start thinking of problems for it.
Exactly.
And it kind of doesn't give them a chance, does it?
Yeah.
So if I don't ask permission, then again, I'm agreeing to take the responsibility. I've got to deliver.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got to prove to them that I'm right. I have to earn it. But that's part of the real rush for me. Is don't ask permission. Just say, this is what it is. It's really exciting. Come along with me. And that so many writers feel like they have to ask somebody's bloody permission to do anything, and you won't. You don't. It can be anything. You can write in vernacular. You can write in weird structure. You can do anything you want. Just do it with vigor and commitment and belief in yourself and joy. And the reader's going to respond to that, even if it's not a joyous story. They're going to respond to you're doing something that is making you feel fantastic. And they're going to, the chances of them loving it are 100-fold more than if you were just trying to please them.
That feels like fantastic advice to end on.
Yeah, it does. Brilliant.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
It's been really lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
So, Patrick Ness there. Do you get the feeling, Tom, that Patrick was trying to get us to harness our spite and defiance in that little chat? You know, he talked about that being quite a good motivator.
Yeah, yeah.
I got the feeling he was just very gently kind of twisting the knife in order to get us to bloody knuckle down and do some more writing.
Yeah.
Did you get that sense?
Yeah. I did like his advice about, which I know, and he said it's dead obvious, but it's brilliant advice about just writing what you need to read, like writing for yourself, like writing something that you want to read rather than trying to please others or...
Yeah, second guess what...
Yeah, yeah, or trying to write to a particular style. And we've talked about it loads over the years, haven't we, in the podcast?
Yeah.
About how you can't kind of try and chase the zeitgeist. And so you just have to...
Enjoy yourself.
Throw yourself open to look, but enjoy what... Yeah, and I think he's right when you see... When people are enjoying what they're writing, you get taken along with it, even if it's not your kind of thing.
No, I agree.
A lot of truth in that.
Yeah, I feel like he gave us just a little bit of a kick in the nuts, though, at the same time. But we do need that as well, so it's kind of good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's interesting. There are, over the time we've been doing these podcast episodes, I feel like there's been a handful of writers that we've spoken to who who have almost like unambiguously been a bit irritated by our lack of effort. Do you know what I mean? I feel like Patrick was one of them. He's like, you guys just need to fucking do some writing.
Yeah.
But hang on. Here's another thing, though.
Mm.
Are they always the people who don't have kids?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Is that what links those people? The ones that always seem really baffled by our lack of output. So I think we can totally use our kids as an excuse.
I think this is your problem. You're just always looking for an excuse.
That is probably true. I'm trying to find something that links all those people together and then just I can just put them to one side.
I think this is your problem, John. You always want this kind of like, there must be a magic reason that all this happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes there just isn't.
Aren't we all like that? Aren't we all like that, Tom?
I don't know.
We're all looking for a way out, aren't we?
Yeah, but you think there's some kind of magic formula.
I do.
If I do X, Y, and Z.
If I could just get up an hour earlier.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. If I could just do this, then I'd have that book written.
Well, I'll tell you what, John. Right now, right here, before next episode where we launch our amazing biggest ever cash prize competition in association with Scrivener, why don't we promise each other, hand on heart, pinky promise, having a cuddle, however, what the best way, I don't know what the best way to make a promise is these
days.
Got
weird at the end, but
Touching noses?
Yeah.
Touching noses.
That'll do.
Is that a thing? It's not. I mean, let's do that now. Let's promise that next episode, we will start by saying, right, what have you written? And we will have a positive, nay, impressive answer.
Yeah, because we have got a sort of unspoken promise at the moment to ask the question, haven't
we?
There's been
a period recently where we've not been able to get down to the amount of writing that we might have wanted to.
I love the way you're making this sound as though you're not making excuses as well.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Like it's entirely just me making excuses.
Mine's very much situational, John. I'm not making excuses. It's just fact. I'm not grasping for excuses. Excuses are finding me. It's very different. Very different indeed. But let's do it. Yeah.
I like that, Tom. That's good. We need a bit more of that. That's great. Okay. We're going to rub noses now?
So this time, in 2 weeks' time, we will have written, I don't know, what's reasonable, 50,000 words. Yeah?
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. 55. Yeah. 55.
Something.
No.
80. Whatever. Let's just do it, yeah?
Can we just... say 10. How about that?
10 words. 10. I can do that. I can bloody do
1,000 words.
No, we just need to come back and say we've actually done something, okay?
Exactly, yeah. Something reasonably substantial not just
but back
like...
Back to what Patrick was saying. Something that we'd like want to do and it's exciting. We come back and go, oh my God, I've written this. And it's brilliant.
So do we rub noses now or then? When do we do that?
I don't. Both, I guess.
Okay. Would you? Let's lock it in with a little rub. Okay.
Right.
Good.
Onwards.
Hey, Tom, you know how we've been doing quite a lot of whinging about no one reviewing us for ages?
Yeah.
Tell me, because I haven't actually checked for a long time, has that encouraged any of our listeners to actually do that? Send any glowing appraisals of our output?
It doesn't appear to have done so, John, no.
If we could, we'd be kissing you. Thank you so much for listening to us rambling on with a silly old chat. Gambling on us, we appreciate that. We begged and we tried being subtle, and you know we don't wanna be no trouble. And whilst we thank you just for being you, would it fucking kill you just to leave us a review?
Fair enough, John. if you've got a strong opinion about things.
We don't mind. Look, even if you don't review us, we love you. And
that's what you're saying in your spoken words, John. Your sung words sounded slightly different.
Look, I was just playing a character there, Tom.
Right.
When I sing, I do it in character.
Okay.
I don't even know if it makes any. Does it make any difference to the stats? The pod boffins kind of seem to say that reviews don't really make much of a difference.
But I think they do to people. finding it and
well, that's true.
Looking at it and thinking, oh, well, this has got some decent reviews. I'll give that a go.
That's true. Keeps us going as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Shall we move on now to our regular feature with an irregular name?
Yeah, let's. That's very well put, John. You are indeed a wordsmith.
I'm a world right, Tom.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah, that never did catch on, that, did it?
God, it's early days, man.
Yeah.
So you know how it works by now. You send us the first three chapters of your work in progress, whatever state it's in, and we bring it to life.
Yep, in if you're whippy and you know it, clap your hands.
Yeah, so what we got, how are we following last week's sapphic fantasy, Tom?
Yeah.
What have you got for us today?
This one is very interesting, actually. It's called Minute Past Midnight from Kalina Holtzapfel that sent it in to us. And interesting because this has actually been published by a small publisher that then, I think, went out of business or stretched itself too thin or something like that. So it came back to Kalina in terms of being able to share it with us and what have you. And she's going to self-publish it to get it out there. So it's a story with a bit of a tortured history.
Mm.
And in a way, fits in with the story itself that has a really fascinating concept at the centre of it, I thought. Mm. And it's, without wishing to ruin it for everyone listening before we read it to you, there's, how would you describe it? A boy and his brother, one of whom doesn't really exist, but does
sort of
is trapped in the mirror, and then is able to swap.
Anyway, don't give it away. Let's have a listen. Let's listen to the first bit.
Yeah, so no, it's just I thought it was such a good concept, wasn't it? Like as a thing.
It's creepy.
Well, yeah. All right. Here's chapter one, and this is chapter one is David, and David's the creepy one stuck in the mirror.
Minute Past Midnight. By Kalina Holtzapfel. Chapter 1. David. I press my hand against the cold surface of the mirror. I hate it here. Today's the day I need to leave. Hide your loved ones, because David's coming out for one hell of a joyride. Of course, I waited for them to come to me with their silly little plan to banish me to the spirit world or wherever they think they will send me. Joke's on them. See, I didn't want to do this, but they seriously pissed me off. I heard their footsteps. It's time. I focused my gaze on my father. Showtime. While Daniel was busy spewing useless gibberish, Father grabbed his razor and cut Daniel across the neck. It wasn't lethal. I didn't want him dead. I had much better plans for him. For now, I just needed some of his blood. Dan's next. Their blood pooled together, seeping into the mirror, opening the gate. You're it! I cackled as I pulled Danny into his new hell cell. What are you doing? Let me go! He screamed. I didn't care. He started screaming as I shut the wardrobe in his face, laughing maniacally. Now that I finally freed myself from that fucking mirror, I had some work to do. Daniel kept hammering his fists against the glass, so I grabbed the mirror and stuffed it into the wardrobe. In doing so, I almost tripped and fell, breaking it as well as myself. I clearly was not used to human movement. I flashed Daniel my best smile and closed the doors to the wardrobe. His shouting was a problem. Our mother ran into the room to see what the ruckus was. She started screaming as her eyes locked onto our dad's corpse on the bathroom tiles. I forgot to close the fucking door. Oh, did I mention? I was butt naked. Luckily for me, Mummy Dearest was stupid enough to run toward her husband. Quietly and slowly to avoid falling and breaking my neck, I made my way over to her and grabbed her head while she was distracted and smashed it against the bathtub. Now, everything in its own time. First, I put on some clothes. I wasn't aware how vulnerable not being covered feels until now. I opened the wardrobe, made a face at Daniel, and grabbed some clothing. They were too big for me, but what can one do? I'd leave the hair for later. It would be easier to explain that than the two dead bodies in my bathroom. As I walked barefoot to the kitchen, I noticed how big my feet were. I heard each heavy footstep with a newfound clarity as my ears adjusted to this new world. after selecting a chef's knife, I went back to finish off Mummy. I tied her wrists and ankles so she couldn't run away when she woke up. If they hadn't plotted against me, everything would be completely different, but no. They had to betray me. Now they all get what they deserve. I gently caressed her head as I waited for her to wake up. She looked so peaceful, despite the cracked, bloody eyebrow. Unlike our father, she looked tiny and fragile. I wondered for a split second whether I shouldn't kill her. However, I knew she'd ruin my plans by trying to help her favourite Daniel. So I needed to follow my instincts. I checked her pulse in case I was waiting for nothing and then slapped her so she'd wake up. I was done waiting. She opened her eyes and looked at me in a daze, not realising what was happening at first. Before she had had a chance to fully comprehend what was going on, I stabbed her in the heart and watched the life leave her eyes. I held her over the drain so that her blood conveniently ran right into it. Impatiently, I lifted her by the ankles to speed up the blood loss. The idea was good, but carrying it out, not so much. For the second time tonight, I almost killed myself as I lifted her. One of my legs slipped on the blood and I almost split my head open right on the edge of the bathtub. Wouldn't that be poetic? But I held on. I was hoping motor function would come a lot more easily than it did. Everything was still going according to plan, but the next few minutes were so fucking boring, I could have just died. Waiting for someone's blood to leave their body is a pretty annoying and long process. Besides, my legs were shaking from the added weight. I could barely stand up myself, let alone when holding even a tiny human, but sometimes sacrifices have to be made. I laid her body on the tiles and washed the blood off my feet so I could go get a more serious instrument with which to carve her. I started carving up the bodies with a butcher's knife and saved the delicacies like hearts, livers and eyes. Since I had to cook for my birthday, I didn't have time to deal with the brains. Thanks, Daniel. Or I guess, Mum. There were a bunch of ingredients around the kitchen, but nothing cooked yet. Annoyed, I disposed of the bodies, cleaned everything up and cut my hair to look like Dan. I'm no expert, but hair doesn't grow that quickly, I think. So, the food. I have absolutely no fucking clue what to do or how. My stomach filled with pain as I sat on the couch pondering my next move. Oh, what the hell? It's my birthday! Daniel's friends, Alex and Martin, will take me out for food. It would be nice not to think about that, but my stomach kept growling and churning. Is that a normal thing for humans? I showered to erase all traces of that afternoon from my body. I only had half an hour until it was time for my friends to come over. To be honest, I really didn't want to deal with them. Plus, when the water is at that warm, really nice temperature, it just makes me want to stay in the shower forever. I looked through all the bottles on the shelves. I fumbled through reading the instructions thanks to the few lessons Dan gave me years ago. We never talked about what you do in the shower. I only knew that humans took showers so they didn't stink. Shampoo is for hair, but it says it treats hair loss. My hair is perfect, thanks, but since there really wasn't much of a choice, I used it anyway. It lathered up nicely. It was really fun to play with, but no fun when it gets in the eyes. Felt like they were burning inside of my skull. Tears streamed down my face as I washed it all off. I even contemplated holding my eyes open under the stream, but I didn't think that would feel great, and after a while the stinging went away. I walked cautiously across the wet tiles. My legs shook from my weight. I was very thin, but that would quickly change. I looked for comfortable clothes in the drawers where I wouldn't have to see Daniel again. The jeans I tried on were too uncomfortable to wear. They chafed my sensitive skin. I found some soft pants and put them on. They felt much better. I went for a long sleeve shirt. No buttons. They required movements much too precise for my less than dexterous fingers, so I avoided them. The doorbell rang as I was looking at myself in the mirror. I worried they would know I wasn't Dan. Even if they could, I suspected people wouldn't doubt that I'm my brother. After all, these things don't happen in real life, do they? The second his friends arrived, I thought they already knew I wasn't my brother. They lunged at me and gave me a hug and a near panic attack. I did not enjoy that. Why do people do this? Can't you just say, Happy birthday. Now let's eat. I fumbled awkwardly as I searched for Danny's coat and belongings, while his friends just blabbed away in the entrance area, which was a bit of a cramped space. Alex smelled so bad. Couldn't tell why, though. How rude would it be if I told him about showers? He wasn't unattractive, so that smell baffled me. Alex always kept his hair really short, and his eyes were a confusing colour between green and brown, maybe. His skin looked deliciously bronzed. Meanwhile, Martin was his complete opposite. He smelled really nice and clean, and his curly black hair was quite bouncy today. His eyes seemed to match the colour of his hair, and he was paler, and he always wore those black, thick-rimmed glasses. We were all dressed in a similar fashion, which meant I didn't royally fuck up dressing myself. I seemed to be the tallest of the three, but Alex was a close second. I know Danny's 6 foot, but judging by the way his pants fit me, I may be a bit taller, which now became the focus of my stress. After I told them I'd spent the day with my parents, Alex suggested we go to a club after dinner. He had a cigarette behind his ear. Neither Danny nor I smoked, but that dude could barely be seen without a cigarette between his lips. I guess I could go to a bar with them, but first food, please. If I don't eat something soon, my brother won't have any friends anymore. And glasses over here. Oh, he's already starting to look tasty. I took Daniel's phone and wallet, and we left.
There you go, just your bog standard mirror boy murdering eating thing, really.
Yeah. Are we a little bit worried about Kalina?
I don't know.
When I read this, I wasn't sure whether to, you know, congratulate her or call for some psychiatric help, I'm being honest.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think it's a really good, like I said before, I just think it's a lovely, solid concept, isn't it? I think it's, you know, when you know you've hit a good idea is when it's just something, it's really simple.
It is, yeah.
There's not like some massively complicated world to it. It doesn't need over-explaining. But it's something outlandish, but something you can instantly understand.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Stranger Things in a way.
Yeah, that kind of...
Someone like stuck in this slightly darker version of our world, like through a mirror.
It reminded me of Superman. You know, in the Superman film, where the baddies from Krypton get stuck in the prison that's just a revolving two-dimensional piece of glass.
Yes.
That used to freak me out when I was a kid. They were just stuck in the glass until it was broken later on, wasn't it?
Kalina hasn't sent us the synopsis of, like, the entire book, so we have no idea what goes down in the rest of the book. But, we could talk about the following chapter. The point of view switches to Daniel, who is the brother.
The normal human brother.
The normal bloke. But he isn't, obviously, he's now inside the mirror because they've swapped places. And he begins to sort of tell the story of how he had this imaginary friend as a kid.
Who wasn't imaginary to him, was he, really?
No, exactly.
He couldn't understand why people couldn't see him.
That's it. But you get the sense that the twin brother wasn't kind of evil at that point and just sort of progressively gets weirder because he makes friends. Daniel makes friends with somebody, kind of his first real friend at school. And then suddenly David disappears and ends up in the mirror. So it's almost like him getting the friend is what cast him into this other world. And that's when he starts to kind of become increasingly disturbed. But yeah, really, like you say, really nice concept. And then the third chapter switches back to David again, the evil one. So you kind of get you sort of have the assumption that that's the format of the book, kind of going backwards and forwards.
So what do you think is the long game in this, John? Do you think it will be supernatural and stay there, or do you think it will be that there's some kind of split personality mental thing going
because
on?
Because he's like a psychotherapist or something.
Yeah, so there could be an interesting sort of double twist in that. I don't know.
I got the sense that, I mean, I know what you mean. I had the same thought, like, is it really a real person? But then you think, well, there's bodies strewn all over the place. And where is he? If he's in the mirror in the wardrobe, is he just hiding in the... I don't know.
But the mirror could just be a metaphor for a dark part of his mind.
Yeah. And he's just shoved himself in the
and
wardrobe.
That's how he's expressing it with himself. Yeah.
It's possible.
So no, but that makes for fascinating... That's great, isn't it, when you're going into the third, fourth chapter of a book and you're trying to join the dots and work it out.
Yeah.
That's where you want to be.
Exactly. I thought the voice for the characters was good. I liked the way she writes for the evil twin, David.
Yeah, it's very matter of fact, isn't he?
Almost sort of childlike. And I thought that was clever because he hasn't spent very much time in the real world. So he's got almost like an innocent way of speaking.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Which almost makes it more disturbing because he's speaking in this quite innocent way, but he's also talking about eating people and things.
He does like eating people, doesn't he?
He does like eating people.
I'm starting to wonder with last episode's murdering assassins, and then a few weeks back we had blooming Dracula going around eating people as well. Don't know if we're attracting the wrong kind of crowd, John. You know what I mean? Why aren't people sending us stories about like flowers and butterflies and stuff for us?
Where are all those?
Yeah, I don't know. But no, he's
gone a little bit mental. Can you guess my favourite line from the
All right, okay.
Tom? I put a little gold star. We might have to bring the fanfare out for this one, Tommy.
Your favourite line.
Did anything spring off the page for you?
I don't know. Now you've put me on the spot.
The bit I really liked was the line, and again, this sort of goes back to that slightly, like the way he says it is almost just as disturbing as what he's saying, but he goes out for dinner with the brother's friends, pretending that he is the brother, you know, the Daniel character. And he says, "I was so hungry, I could eat both of my brother's friends right there and then. Luckily for them, we went to a restaurant first, where I ate like a pig. Beef is so much like human meat. Both have the same structure, but humans don't get caught in your teeth as much." I thought that was a really good little line because it just came out of nowhere a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a lot of inference in that, and it was quite disturbing, and it was also the way it's written again. But I thought that was very good. A cracking line. I tell you what I wasn't so fond of.
Oh, go on. John has criticism, shocker. Go on, then.
Where is that gold? That was, you know, for me, a gold star moment.
Yeah.
That was, it wasn't, I was going to say it was implicit in its cannibalism, but it actually it's not that, it's not very implicit at all, but it's sort of subtle, but not actually going there. But the bit where he takes the girl home and kills her, I wasn't so keen on that. Don't think I'm not very good with very graphic violence,
right?
Especially towards vulnerable people. And I know that that is sort of horror films. That horror films are basically predicated on that trope. But
well, that's good that it made you feel like that, then, isn't it? That's doing its job.
Yeah, but I think I prefer it. I don't know. I think when stuff gets very graphic, I think I prefer my horror maybe just more like a creepy hidden threat. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But cannibalism.
Funny, because you weren't saying that about the lesbian sex in last episode.
No, I like that out there.
Right, okay.
I like that, straight on a plate, please. it's quite a grim thing, isn't it, cannibalism?
Yeah. Do you know, actually, there was something about that whole thing that I didn't like, was the idea that he just kind of picked up this girl in a club, and you think, would he be able to do that? Because he's obviously not comfortable in the world yet.
And he sort of... He's kind of staggering around a bit, isn't he? Because his muscles aren't quite there after being
in the
mirror
world. Yeah,
that's
what I mean. So he's not like he's going to be some great catch.
Yeah. He's not walking with swag, is he?
No, but it was just kind of like, I just picked up a girl.
You didn't get his chat up line.
No, I think maybe it needed a little bit. It needed to show, that would be a good way to show a slightly different dimension to his character, wouldn't it? That he could switch into this.
Very confident.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe then that would be where he's like pretending to be his brother more so than using. Because there's nice bits on it where he kind of leans into using his brother or what he's learnt from his brother or with his brother and using it in the real world. Maybe that just needed a little bit of how he would actually get the relatively good-looking girl with dyed dark red hair
to come home
with him.
Yeah.
But no, on the whole, very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Very enjoyable.
She's good as well, I think, at doing this sort of drip. We've talked about this before, but drip-feeding information. Because I think there's always a temptation to over-explain everything right from the beginning. Do you know what I mean? Especially when you're kind of building a world like this, you've got lots of new information that a reader won't necessarily get. But she drops you right in the action,
which is great.
Yeah, and she doesn't go, "Let me explain about this mirror thing and how it works." we get straight into him.
There is an art form, isn't there, dropping these bits in and for the reader to be coming along with you going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Ah, right, yes, because, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And almost predicting where they're going to go, well, I wonder what happens with, oh, that's what happens with.
yeah, exactly. You need things explaining, but you don't want them all explaining at the same time. It's always an interesting balance. It's like you're feeding the reader enough to keep them turning the page, but you don't want to give everything away. You want to keep it all intriguing.
It's like leaving a little trail of treats, isn't it, for a dog or a cat to try and move them from one place to another. If you put them too far apart, they lose interest.
Yeah.
And if you put them too close together, they just eat them all at once.
Yeah.
And then wander off somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it's about just spacing them absolutely the right space.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. That's a good analogy. That's going in the book. That's going in the failing writer's book.
Should do, shouldn't it?
Great writing.
Yeah.
So I think what I learned from that is that cannibalism, literally and literally, is an acquired taste.
Right, is not okay. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, well done. Another almost finished book, depending on what, if you...
Yeah, and that's going to be, she's going to release that on Amazon once she's got it all formatted and what have you. So hopefully we'll be able to update with that and pop it in the show notes at some point in the very near future. And go out and buy it.
So, on to the next thing. We've already told you what's coming up next week, so we don't need to do that.
Is it our biggest ever flash fiction competition in association with Scrivener?
That is exactly what it is, Tom.
People should listen to that.
They probably should. And if they want a sneaky peek at what is the kinds of things that might win, because, of course, we are talking to our star judge, and so we will be talking about the kinds of things that might help you win.
And we'll be doing the phrase that has to be included, so you won't win without that, will you?
Exactly. That's not going to work. So, I think that's going to be a fascinating little chat. So, tune in next time.
Yeah, next time where we'll be talking competitions and me and John will be telling you all about all the writing we've been doing.
Yes!
That we've promised.
I'd already forgotten that.
I know. Sorry about that.
We only talked about that just a few minutes ago. Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Right, well.
Lots of writing, Tom. Lots of writing. We've got lots of time to do it as well. Yeah. So,
until then, dearest listeners,
keep writing, take care, and see you next time for the big one. Bye-bye.
Just to clarify, when you said the big one then, do you mean it's our biggest ever flash fiction competition with the biggest ever cash prize in association with Scrivener? Is that what you're referring to?
That's exactly what I was referring to, Tom. But, yeah, just in case there's any confusion.
I don't know if we mentioned it.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?